The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, producer of the show. And of course, we have another fantastic guest for you today. And I'm talking about platinum-selling, Grammy Award-winning, Dove Award-winning, Billboard Music Award-winning singer, songwriter, and frontman for the group Mercy Me, writer of the song I Can Only Imagine and the Lionsgate Roadside Attractions box office hit of the same name, and all around, down-to-earth, salt-of-the-earth, good guy. Yes, Bart Millard is in the house today. Now, Bart used to think he was an Enneagram 7, but he identifies now as an Enneagram 6. So join us as we go down the wormhole today. That's it for me, Anthony Skinner. And now here is your host, Ian Cron.
Bart Millard, welcome to Typology.
Thanks for having me, finally.
Yeah, man. As we were saying earlier, it's hard to believe that we have lived in pretty much the same town for 11 years, have so many mutual friends, Randy and Katie Williams, especially, mm-hmm. and we have never met before.
Yeah, it is very hard to believe. Like I've known you from the Enneagram stuff long before I realized that some of your dearest friends are some of our dearest friends. And so it's finally get to meet you.
Well, who knows? We probably have some scuttlebutt that we've been told about each other. We'll find out if it comes out in the wash, and then we can blame Randy and Katie for it somewhere down the road. So you self-identify as an Enneagram 6, the loyalist. And I'm just curious, what led you to conclude that you were a 6?
Well, from the time that I kind of learned the whole Enneagram thing and what it was, I was 100% certain I was a 7, and I'm not sure exactly how it all works, but I still believe that, man, there's definitely a 7 there. Like, you know, I tried all the questions and all that stuff, and if I took it 4 times, I would get close results, but 4 different results. 'Cause then, you know, and I don't know if it's my trust issues as a 6, but it's like, wait a minute, if I have to answer this as a 20-year-old or answer this as a 48-year-old, you know, and like, I would get different answers because I was like, I feel like I felt more like a 7 back then when the whole world was ahead of me. And then what's funny is like talking to friends about it and having all these conversations, you know, I would read like just the descriptions of different ones, like, you know, because they're not going to sit and take a test over dinner. And over several months of reading through that, like every time I would read through what a 6 was, I kind of got this weird thing like, oh man, like I think I'm more of a 6 than I am, more probably a 6 with 7 wing. And when I realized, yeah, I definitely am, like I was depressed for a while. Like I was kind of bummed out because I guess the whole Peter Pan side of 7 was so exciting and stuff. And maybe it's more of what I would like to be seen as, but there is definitely a motivation of fear and a mutual friend, Katie, being a 6, definitely kind of made me realize, oh yeah, I'm 100% a 6. Like, just the little things of like, it's like, there are issues of, trust when no matter who I meet at first, but then the second we break through that, I would take a bullet for them, man, to a fault almost. Like, I'm in no matter what. It's just hard. It takes a little time to get to that point. And so my guard is always up. And yeah. And so, so as much as I've kind of read through it and stuff, it's like, it just kind of, it resonated more than anything else. And there's definitely a 7 wing, but a 6 is kind of home base, if you will.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I tell people is that in terms of wings, you can have what's called a heavy wing. You can have a moderate wing or you can have a light wing. And if you have a heavy wing, sometimes, like this was my experience, I'm a four with a three wing, but my three wing is so heavy that it took me a long time to realize that I was a four, because I'd be vacillating back and forth, you know? And, but what sealed it for me was the unconscious motivation, right? I definitely identified with the unconscious motivation of the four more than the three. So the six's unconscious motivation is a need to feel safe, secure, and supported in a world that feels chaotic, unpredictable, and threatening.
Yeah. Right?
And for the seven would be the need to avoid psychological and emotional pain through constantly living in this future of incredible escapades and adventures, always planning fun, always thinking about the next fun thing we're going to do, and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So if, in a way, if the six copes with fear through a kind of pessimism sometimes, the seven deals with fear through optimism. So it's the same anxiety. It's just two different management systems. So of those two, which sounds more like you?
Presently the six, and that's and that's kind of why it's hard to answer, because it's like I feel like the seven part of me or whatever has almost gotten me to this point. Like there was a motivation, and the reason I took the risk and started a band and did all this crazy stuff that people thought there's no way, find something to fall back on, and I resonated with that for so long. And then like I said, like I don't know enough about to know like if I guess it's a thing, but like currently, and I would even say with all the success we've had and people that you would consider friends that end up just wanting something from you, I went from an extrovert to an absolute introvert. Like I just, I kind of shut myself in. And so like, that's when it's hard to answer. Like, yeah, I feel like most of my life there was a seven, like this, just everything was about wonder and nothing to stop me, to where now it's like you hit a point to where this six is like rearing its head like crazy. Even the motivation is different, and it's, there is this sense of wanting to be accepted and be safe and stuff like that, but I don't know, just kind of built these weird kind of walls, if that makes sense, and just you know, and became incredibly more loyal to the people that I do consider dear friends, and don't take it for granted like I probably did in the past. But at the same time, it just takes a little bit to kind of let people that I'm just meeting in, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So, you know, that's really interesting. I remember hearing Eugene Peterson say something that was sort of brought me, you know, sort of threw me back on my heels. He said, someone asked him, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen to the human soul? And without blinking, he went, celebrity.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It's like, you know, people that win the lottery, it's like you don't hear many success stories and that kind of stuff. And it's
no, you don't.
Yeah.
No, you don't. And I think you've described some of the trauma of celebrity, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, who are my friends? Why does this person want to hang with me? What's the real motivation? Do they want a selfie or do they want to know me? You know,
right.
Is it on and on and on? You know, what are the motivations these people have? You become skeptical and cynical a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, who knows? Maybe as we talk, we'll hone in maybe on the six, or maybe we'll leave the conversation with, let's take a look at seven.
Yeah. 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 That's, I don't know if it's like, yeah, if it's, which is like, that's the whole thing with like, you know, what is it truly? Cause like I could say at 20, when I'm not married with kids, like I approach things differently, to where there's just so much more that factors in, and just, you know, I don't know. I don't know. It's the, which it is. I know I feel like a six, and it's kind of, yeah. It's like, I feel like a six, but want to be a seven. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I like to say, I think I said this on the road back to you, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'd like to be a Stephen Colbert seven, but I'm a Bob Dylan four without the talent.
Yeah. I felt the same way. Like I literally, we were in Hawaii doing a show randomly, and I was reading around this whole table stuff, and it hit me like the more I read about a six, I was like, whatever was in the past, like right now, everything about this hits me hard. And I was, I was genuinely bummed out, like in a weird way. And then I've come to like embrace it more, and it doesn't bum me out anymore. It's just it's almost like, how was I duped for a year thinking that I was a seven, as if like there's no part of me, it's a seven all of a sudden, is the way I was acting. You know, but yeah, it's, you know, but at the same way, kind of understanding that, has kind of helped me get to a probably healthier place than I've ever been in my life. Just kind of, you know, it's like you said, it's like you can, when you start to understand this, and it's like, I mean, I remember reading like the sixes, whatever the app is or whatever, where it says like, you know, how to deal with me as a six. And even reading those, I was like, holy cow. Like it was all like revolutionary to me. Just never looked at it that way.
Yeah. And that self-knowledge, as you just were alluding to, that the acquisition of that kind of self-knowledge can have a revolutionary effect on your life. It's like, oh, this explains so much.
Right.
And it really, you know, I hope it, what it does for people too, is it elicits a lot of self-compassion. And the reason I say that is that I also believe that your type, the type that we adopt, this way that we show up for the world, is in part a response to very early trauma. Just is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's partly disposition, temperament, genetics. It's just, you know, some people come in the world more anxious than others. Some people come in the world more depressive than others, et cetera. You know that having children.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but to some meaningful degree, it's also like, how did I cope with trauma? Did I become someone fixated on security and support and safety? Did I kind of retreat into a place where as a seven, I became so future oriented and thinking about fun and happiness to escape painful feelings? Do you see how this could just be trauma driven?
Yeah, no question. Yeah. And I think for me, it for sure is just I've had enough of, you know, like we all have issues growing up with, you know, daddy issues, stuff like that. You know, you talk about the sixth, you know, looking for acceptance or whatever. That's definitely been a huge motivation with everything I've done. You know, just having a dad that had a massive amount of potential, like as far as being a football player and stuff, and it all fell through, and living with a bitter man that, like, so bitter to the point, my dad was supposed to had a chance to play pro football. But back then you got your 4-year degree and then you went to, this is the '60s. It wasn't a high paying job and you definitely finished college. You weren't drafting early. And he ended up quitting. He went to SMU. He quit school early because of either an injury or something like that. And found out like 10 years later, he stayed in touch with the team, that Vince Lombardi's Packers were looking at him as soon as he graduated. Didn't find out until it was way past. And this weird bitterness, like I was named after Bart Starr out of sarcasm, not out of honor, like just out of a fight that my mom and dad had. He decided I want to name him Bart Starr. And it was like this weird anger of just so I don't forget what could have been. And it wasn't in an honoring way. And just he was a different person then. So there's always been this sense of, you know, the kid that tried football, but I was never as good as him, never worked out, and found out I was able to sing. And it didn't matter what the thing was. It was like, even though my dad's saying, don't chase your dreams, get a 9-to-5 job, it's not worth it. Deep down, I was like, this is everything that he wanted. And so nothing was going to stop me, because in my own head, that was the way to please him. That was what was going to make him proud. Even when he fought me most of the way and said, you're crazy, don't do it, I was like, no, I know. And there's no way I want to be him, you know, and say, what if the rest of my life? And so, that's always been a part of it. And, and there's definitely some escapism, just, you know, my dad was abusive early in my life and until his life completely changed. And so that kind of escape that goes along with a seven was definitely a coping mechanism, to say the least. I had no clue what any of this was back then, but I could see there's a weird way there's an affection towards a seven, because I feel like a seven, that part of it almost saved my life, if that makes sense. Like it got me through so much. The reason I have a vivid image, that's where I'd go. That was my security blanket. And, my whole childhood, young adult life was that. But then it's like, there was a moment in my adult life where, you know, went to grief counseling with my wife that led into kind of tapping into my childhood with the way that I respond to things and how I'm a father and a husband. And I think that's when I started to get healthy. And that's when I was kind of, I don't know if I could ever see that I was potentially a six. And then the healthier I got, realized, oh, okay, if we're being honest, this is probably more of the motivation than just I'm Peter Pan the rest of my life. Like there's something deeper here. And And so, yeah, it's been enlightening. I think, Jamie George, I go to Journey and he introduced this to us, you know, a few years ago. And I was just like, what is this? And so, just fascinated with it. So I think that's, I think I'm a six, I don't know, a seven, but that's what it feels like.
And you know, that is, you know, I always like it when someone comes on ambivalent, in part because, you know, sometimes people think, oh, this is going to be easy to figure this out. And this is deep, mysterious, complex material. It's a journey of self-understanding. And like I've told people 100 times, sorry, audience. It took me 10 months and I'm a therapist and a trained Episcopal priest, you know what I mean? And a trained spiritual director. You'd think I'd have gotten in a heartbeat. It's like, no, it's a little bit, it ain't the Myers-Briggs. It's not something you can just stamp out, you know?
Right.
And I'm glad for that. Cause I think people are too complicated to just, you know, throw them in a box fast, you know?
Yeah. That's the hard part. That's kind of, I mean, you're aware more than anything, but it's funny cause like it kind of caught on like wildfire, especially in Nashville of all places, you know, and I'm guilty of it at times, but it's funny when you meet people and they're like, oh no, they're an eight. Like, it's like, well, I don't think that's how this is supposed to be used as far as let's label. I'm like, gotcha. You know, that I'm going to steer clear of them or whatever, but I caught myself doing it. And you're right. It's like, it's so easy to like, it's not trying to compartmentalize something so complex into nine numbers. It's just, it's like, you know, and I, you know, for me, it's been amazing to understand, you know, where people are coming from or, you know, how they resonate, if you will. It changes everything as far as your approach and stuff, man, the whole sleeping at last thing. Like, it's so funny when that whole thing, dude, like I told one friend and it's probably wrong, but I was like, listen to all of them. And the one that wipes you out completely is probably what you are. Cause I can hear the one-on-one and be like, oh, that's beautiful, man. I got to six and I was flat on the floor, like in a million pieces. Mm-hmm. And my wife being a nine was like, she loved them all. She resonated and kind of wept as a six because she's married because of me. But then she got to nine. It's like, she couldn't breathe. And it's one of the most beautiful, from the artwork to everything. It's one of those beautiful things. And I think I have promoted that album probably more than he has. I'm kidding. I've told everyone about it. And everybody that I know, no matter what number they are, it's like without saying a word, you know, that my friends that are threes, they hit that three. The one that was interesting to me, and I'm curious about it. Is there anywhere in there that says that? Cause I feel like eights push my buttons more than anything else. Like as a six, I don't know if that's a thing or what, I'll know some people that are, I guess it's safer to say unhealthy eights that my wife's like, nah, you know, no big deal. And it just drives me crazy. But in that,
so was your dad an eight?
That's a great question.
If you had to guess, I'm just curious.
I don't think he was. Okay. That's a good question. I've always thought of my dad as more of a five, but I haven't given it a ton of thought. He was an abusive man. So, I mean, on any given day, I could say, yeah, he was an eight because I wasn't fond of eights. Like, it's not really the right answer, but it's like,
right.
There is, right. I don't know what it is about that. You know, I mean, or unless it's just the, yeah, I don't know what it is, but I will say in the fact that sometimes the things eights will push our buttons is that when I heard that song for eights, I kind of wept for that too. It's this weird kind of like it said something to me, understanding more what a beautiful, healthy eight is. It almost broke my heart because it's like I've almost kind of written them off as something else, if that makes sense.
And that's what you hope the Enneagram does, right? Not only brings up compassion, but also empathy, right?
Yeah.
For other people, because, you know, we're talking about wounds, right? And how people have responded to wounds and how they continue to live out of them until they get self-awareness and realize, well, you know, this is, who else could I have been given what I went through?
Yeah.
And doesn't give me permission to stay in the shadow aspect of my type. I want to grow and become a healthier person. But of course, this is who I became. Now, I want to ask you a question, though, because I'm asking this of sixes all the time. You know, I feel like right now in the world, we're all sixes. You know what I mean? Like, I think we're all sixes in a way.
Right.
We are living in a time, I would call this the year of anxiety, you know, COVID, the election, you know, all kinds of stuff happening in the world, the economy, people losing their jobs, you know, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, how have you coped in the year of anxiety as a six and being somebody for whom anxiety is like your Velcro for anxiety?
Well, I'm a phobic six, not a counterphobic. It has been challenging and then numbing all at the same time. Like, at some point I check out, like, you know, like it's too much information. I don't know what's right, what to trust or whatever. And so I will retreat into like the studio, and an album that's supposed to come out a year and a half ago, I've intentionally drug it out to have something to do to take my mind off of it. And so, you know, and so it's been I'd say it's the year of retreat for me is what it feels like. Cause you know, in some ways I'm like, man, the pandemic's actually been a healthy thing for our marriage and for me being forced to kind of slow down and kind of stay put and stuff. You know, it hasn't been that bad. I'm never one to do that. And so like when you're forced to, I was like, man, this is okay. I could go without putting my hard pants on anytime soon, you know, in some ways I've kind of checked out, like I don't post anything political. I just don't get involved. None of it's worth the fight is what it feels like to me. And so, you know, I see people that kind of, you know, are friends that are counterphobics that like, you know, that want to take this stuff on, and man, I'm the most passive. You know, one thing, and not to change something, but the one thing you mentioned with 8 that I couldn't get out of my head was there's a part of me as a lead singer of this band where I kind of have to be a leader and be an 8 at times. And it's a part of my job that I've never super enjoyed as far as like, you know, confronting conflict or disagreeing or whatever. I don't know how much that plays a part of like, it's when I have to play those roles. Like I never meant to be a quote unquote leader, if you will, but yes. when those things fall on me, it's like, oh, it's aggravating, especially when I'm a phobic six.
So I think there's probably two dynamics there. One is to remind people that you contain in you all 9 numbers. Mm-hmm. So you're not solely a six, you're just you're dominant six. So, you know, you could behave like a 4, or you could behave like a 1 in certain areas of your life. You may be a perfectionist. Other areas of your life, you know, you're more of a 7. You know what I mean? It's like you have access to all those energies. It's just that 1 tends to be dominant. And then, so, you know, you can access that 8 side. Here's the difference. Unlike an 8, you have to burn more calories to be confrontational. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes, 100%. Right?
The 8 can get energy from that confrontation.
They almost find joy in it. It seems like, and that's what drives me crazy.
They can, if they're really unhealthy in particular.
Yeah.
I think or even if they're healthy, sometimes they just like immediate engagement with people, and they like the juice. They just like the juice, and so it's not even confrontation. Sometimes it's just intensity.
Yeah.
And so I'm a 4, man. I'm in the withdrawing stance. I withdraw from conflict for sure. Like I can do it, but again, I gotta burn calories,
right?
You know,
yeah.
And so that's definitely, I think, one piece of it for sure. You know, and I would say, you know, here's the trouble with being a 6 in the spotlight. Like, and you tell me if this is true, but this would be sort of iconic 6. Sixes typically don't like to be out front. And the reason is, one is they don't like to be scrutinized, and they don't like to be up front because then they're exposed. And if they're too successful, then people are looking at them too closely, and that makes them vulnerable to attack.
Right.
And they're like, oh, you know, oh, they get really squirrely when they're out front. They would rather, they like being encouraged or affirmed, just not too much. So I guess one question I would have for you is, how's that celebrity working out for a six?
Well, you know, it's interesting because like that holds true in a little different way as far as like, our big joke is like, you know, I'm the most unlikely front man or lead singer of a band. Like I'm out of shape. I'm 12 feet taller than most artists, it feels like. And like, I mean, we spent so much of our career, like, you know, doing shows as like a Toby Mac or these guys, they're doing backflips and they're, you know, and I literally stand in my mic and then walk to my water bottle, come back. That's it. Like, I'm not that entertaining. And there's a part of me that fits right in that. Like I'm not going to jump through hoops. I refuse to do any of that stuff to quote unquote, if that's what it takes to entertain, I'm out. And so that definitely holds true. The one thing that's interesting for me is I've done it for so long that I've found this weird comfort. Like it would be easier to sing in front of 10,000 people than to sit in a room with one of you guys and do this, because even though it's 10,000 people, no one will interrupt me or can get to me on stage. And so I find myself being a million times more vulnerable setting up a song or on stage than I would one-on-one a lot of times. Cause it's very ironic to say, I feel safer there than anywhere else, because of course there's people out there, can't see them because of spotlights, but they're not going to go, yes, but, or ever pry into me. I have complete control to say what I want to say and dictate the narrative. And so, you know, healthy or not, it's like, it's become like a safe place for me, but on the entertainment side and just being a lead singer, it's like, there's a very cynical side to me of like, whatever I do will immediately come across insincere. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as far as all the antics, nobody wants to see a guy my size try to do a high kick, but, you know, that's what it feels like. That's what goes to my head during a whole show is like, you know, and so.
No, but now you've got me seeing you doing a high kick, yeah, which is like, you're killing me right now.
And there'll be like, I'll do it to make the band laugh, but I could never do it with a straight face. Like, this is what they want. Oh my gosh. That mortifies me to think like that. And so I get up there. When I was a kid, my parents divorced when I was three and I lived with my dad. My dad wouldn't come home from work till like six. So when I get out of school, I'd walk to our church that kind of raised me, and I'd go in the sanctuary and I'd play on the piano by myself because I loved how it echoed and sing. And one day my pastor saw me through like the side door and I was kind of embarrassed. And he just walked up and he said, man, he goes, if you can figure out what you're doing now. And he meant like, if you can figure out a way to like, peel your chest open and let people see your heart, they'll follow you anywhere. And that's been a part of me. I mean, I've held on that for so long that it's almost the point where it's like, man, I'm just here to sing. Like I'm not doing any backflips. I'm not, you know, it's, you know, it to a very almost sarcastic level, if you will. And, but you know, I wouldn't change any of that, but it's a weird, the more successful we've gotten, the more I've kind of retreated to, you know, I have a handful of dear friends that, you know, include, and, you know, the band, some of my best friends in the world, but dear friends outside of what I do. And I would lay my life down for them. But it's like, you know, I'm the guy when they're like, hey, we got to ramp this thing up. Let's start doing shows again. I'm the one that's like, do we need to, are we good? Can't you like cut expenses back, we can keep this going, because I love being alone in the studio making music. And
well, you know, the focus of attention, you know, every type has a focus of attention. So let's say you're a one. When you walk into a room, your attention immediately migrates toward the mistakes. Like, where's the disorder? What requires ordering, let's say? If you're a four on the Enneagram, my attention immediately goes toward what's missing, not what's mistaken, but what's missing, right? That's sort of a letdown. It's like, oh, that's not the ideal that I was hoping for, you know, or anticipating. I could go, you know, I could go through all the numbers and do it, but the focus of attention for sixes is what could go wrong and how do I prepare?
Yep.
Right. Yep. And I'm just wondering, are you a worst case scenario thinker?
Yep. Absolutely. I'm telling you, you know, the, on the sleeping at last song, like there's probably some obvious ones that could, oh, I can see why you cried. I cried when he talks about being on a plane looking for the exit row, you know, and like preparing, you know, for the worst. That it wrecked me in the first verse. Cause I was like, my gosh, my whole life you should just sneak in on some of our band meetings. Cause they're like this. And I'm like, but we have to prepare for the worst. What if this happens? What if this? And they're like, okay. And, you know, and once I'm convinced, I'm in, but it's like, I have to go through it all. That part drives me crazy, but I do it all the time. Like buying a car is a beat down for me. Like, it's like the six or the seven wing or whatever. It's like, I analyze everything. I think everyone's trying to screw me. Like we built a house, the sweetest man on the planet. He has never done anything wrong. And if I've got to call him to say, hey man, we've got a door jam that's stuck or whatever, it'll take me a couple of hours because in my head, I'm ready for the fight. There's never been a fight. Mm. He's never done anything but been there immediately. But every time I believe, it's like, this is where he got me. He totally got me. He's going to put in a, you know, I go there every time and it drives me crazy.
Yeah, like you're talking there about the sort of the natural suspiciousness that eights have or sixes have of other people. Mm. It's like other people have a hidden agenda. It's like, oh, maybe he got a cheaper door than the one I ordered, and
yep.
you know, and
yep. then 100%.
Is that an agenda? And then on top of that, there you're already planning and preparing in your head for the worst case, which is I'm going to have an argument with this guy, yep. and it's going to be really. And then, of course, you know, how many of these things actually happen? You know, yeah. when was the last time you needed to know in reality where the exit was on the airplane?
Right.
You never, right? But it's always ramping up for the worst.
Then as a phobic, I end up avoiding the phone call altogether. It's like I talk myself out of it, or I'm in the car going, how dare you, sir? I'm ready. And then I finally do run into him, like, sweetest guy on the planet. I had nothing to worry about. It's like right. you talk about burning calories. I burned calories an hour before the phone call.
Yes. Yes, totally. I totally get that. And if you ever get a chance, listen to Sarah the Barge's interview with me on sixes. And she talks about, I don't even go up to first class when I'm upgraded because, you know, they die first when the plane goes down. Like the statistical averages are greater that you will die in first class versus coach.
Yeah.
And I'm like, let me die in first class.
Yeah. I'm not that bad, but I do process it. It's so funny when it's like flying, when it's completely out of my control, I can let it go. Like, you know, it's like, yeah, I have people that are like, I can't fly. Aren't you freaking out? I'm like, no, man, like there's no analyzation I can make to change this situation. He's got to fly the plane and I got to get there. So I can let that go. It doesn't consume me. But then little things that do seem like they're in my lap takes a while.
It's so interesting because it seems like the you that you're describing right now, it would have been really hard to, you know, launch the band in those early days, all the things you have to do, you know? And I just wonder, like, I mean, you must have been rocking it as a seven, like leaning into that wing with all the optimism you had to have had. I saw the movie too. Even in the movie, it's sort of depicted as you being super optimistic with a lot of vision moving forward, you know?
Yeah. And that's why I say it's a little confusing because looking back as a six, I was like, there's no reason why this band would happen or whatever. But as a seven, it's always made sense. That's why I kind of thought, oh, totally. That's me, you know? And, you know, and it's also a part of me going, well, maybe I'm not a fan of the 40 something year old me. I really like that 20 year old. So I'm the seven or whatever, you know, it's like, and I can see parts of that and, you know, sure, circumstances take place, even the death of my father and success, those things that were a huge part of this. It's like, you know, my manager, I was talking to him, and when the movie came out, we took a break afterwards, and our last album came out 2017. This one will come out this year in April, so it's almost about 4 years, and it's a long story waited. And I was telling manager, I was like, man, I don't feel like finishing working on the record. Like I didn't want to do it. And it was interesting because he said, well, he goes, because in a way you've made it. And I was like, what are you talking about? He goes, well, you almost have to generate or not fabricate and lying, but create suffering. Like I lament well. And a lot of the songs that mean so much to me are, you know, and I don't really enjoy songwriting because it means I have to go to a place that's painful and hang out for a little bit. I love the result, but it's hard. It takes a while for me to go back there. And he was kind of like, all you've dreamed of is to kind of not necessarily like I'm dreaming of being successful, but I've dreamed of being accepted, being taken seriously, to be able to support my family. And when all these things kind of hit at a higher point than I ever thought, it's kind of like feeling fat at the table. It's like, and for him to say, yeah, he goes, you almost have to feel like you have to generate some kind of suffering when right now you're not necessarily suffering as much as maybe you have, or you've tackled a lot of the issues, or you've gotten healthy about them. Alan, it's an interesting approach to, you know, I don't know. It's just, there is a little bit of that to where, you know, I've got dear friends that went through things that probably wouldn't be a huge deal. And I'm sitting here writing four songs about it. I was like, oh, he may be right. I'm just looking for something to latch onto to right. be heartbroken over.
Well, you just need to start writing with Enneagram fours.
Yes, I have a daughter that's right. one, and so we hang out a lot.
Yeah, man. You get a four in the room. I remember I wrote a song with Stu G, who's a four, and it was a song for Michael W. Smith, for Smitty. And the two of us were writing this song, and we just wept through the whole write. I mean, just that's like,
man.
Like this. And I'm not sure Smitty thought it was all that bad. I mean, but we were like, this is awesome. You know, that's fours working together, man.
It's so funny because like I'm typically, like I always joke that I'm just a sports fan or whatever who happens to sing. And that's kind of where I may hover most of the time. But when I'm writing, my four rears its head like crazy. Like I do go there, and that's why it's hard. But it's like, I'm not a fan of being wrecked and wearing my heart on my sleeve. But whether it's on stage or writing, it's the most genuine moments that I have.
Yeah.
And so I wrote with Stu G one time, not knowing any of this about him. And we were writing for some Fanny Crosby album or whatever. And so we had her lyrics and we had to make a song out of it. And Stu just starts playing that weepy guitar that he's so stinking good at. Mm-hmm. And we both started crying without writing a word. We're like, oh my God, the guitar. Can you imagine where we're going to end up? And it was like,
I know.
He was a four. I was like, we both had this kindred spirit of like, just, you know, there are things that'll wreck me on a four level, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. I'll tell you another person, you know, while we're just dropping names, you know, another person I've written with that is a four, and the same thing happens to Cindy Morgan. Cindy is so four, man. And the two of us get together and it is like a melancholy fest. It is just beautiful. It's I don't care if the song ever gets cut. I just want to write with her and get all sad for a day and leave me get in touch with it. All right. So, you know, fours typically have issues around authority figures. Mm-hmm. So let me give you a little, you know, sort of a sense of that. Because the phobic six, for example, looks at authority figures as the source of their security and the source of their safety, right? So they can often ingratiate themselves with authority figures, or they see the authority figure as the person their attention needs to be riveted on, right? Mm-hmm. Now, the counterphobic six will look at the same authority figure, and it's the opposite, right? It's like the phobic six is like, I'm afraid, but that person outside of me is the authority figure, and they're going to take care of me. The counterphobic looks at the authority figure and says, and if that person so much as, you know, deviates from my, you know, or moves outside of the zone of trust, I'm going to take that sucker down. You know what I mean? Like they get, that's why sometimes they look like eights.
Yeah.
Hey everybody. One of the lessons I've learned over the years is that not everybody benefits from a traditional 50-minute counseling session. And this is why some people can go to couples therapy or personal counseling for a long time and never really get anywhere. This is why I'm such a believer of intensive counseling and my friends at Restoring the Soul in Colorado, created by my longtime friend Michael Cusick to help couples or individuals experience deep change and half-day blocks over 1 or 2 weeks. Now listen, if you can't wait months or years to get to the bottom of an issue or to experience breakthrough, you need to get in touch with my friend Michael and his extraordinary team of counselors at Restoring the Soul. If you're looking to get out of the rut you're in but can't wait months or years, call Restoring the Soul today for a free consultation with Michael's staff. Call 303-932-9777 and learn how their intensive counseling counseling process can help you. As a special bonus, just for Typology listeners, make sure to visit www.restoringthesoul.com/typology to download their PDF called 5 Ways Unaddressed Trauma May Be Derailing Your Relationships.
And in reality, you know, there's really not two different sixes, because typically it's on a continuum and people are moving, you know, sixes tend to move more phobic, maybe more counterphobic, and then maybe in the middle, and then which sort of actually coincides with their natural ambivalence, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is part of also being sixes in this age of anxiety. I'm not going into politics at all here. I swear to gosh, I'm not. All right. But what I am going to say is, all of us have been focused on authority figures, regardless of whether it's on the left or the right or whatever. We're right. Just all of us are fixated on authority figures. And I guess the question I would have for you is, at what point do you trust one? Or at what, like, or is that been your experience, whether with teachers or coaches or, you know, I can see where the trauma with your dad as an authority figure could really influence the way that you view it. I mean, are you suspicious of authority figures? Does it take a long time? Just tell me if you have any history.
Yeah. That. Yeah, I am. Yes, there. If I don't know them, there's definitely a suspicion to authority figures, and you know, there's probably a reason why I don't have a desk job, and I, you know, doing something that I'm some kind of in charge of and control of. But it's interesting because this is not you know, without trying to take any kind of political stance. Like sometimes and maybe it has to do with my dad. Sometimes I will give them the benefit of the doubt if they're just good to me. If they just seem like good people, and you know, maybe to a fault. And a great example is, when Trump was just got inaugurated, we got asked to do the presidential prayer breakfast. We actually got asked early on. And before it all went down. And so we, at the time, it wasn't as polarizing. We thought, man, whether it's Trump or Hillary in office, if the president asks me to come and be who I am and what I do, I'll 100% do it. You know, it's like, regardless who it is, that was kind of our take on it. And so we ended up going, and of course, you know, Trump's there. And so we had to sit up on this main table on stage, and it was like me and my wife and like Pence and his wife and some other people. And so I had a chance to talk to Mike Pence, like, and without knowing anything about him, especially then, didn't, because I just, you know, I pay attention a little bit, but I'm not, you know, super hard. Like I said, I probably shut down a retreat on that stuff. And I thought, man, like, he just was a kind person. And I'm sure maybe most of them are, I don't know. But, you know, it's like there was something about him, like, man, he's a super kind person, to where I found myself later, if somebody was dogging some of his views, something inside me already thought, he's a good man. Like I found, whether I even knew what his policies were, because I saw him as a good man, I found myself kind of in a weird way, just defending him in my head, if you will. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and so, totally.
And so I don't know if that's more of the loyalist trust kind of thing. Like, you know, on the flip side of that, like I know people that just from, say, a political standpoint, just from their policies, they already know they hate someone. And I don't think it's a part of me that could be like that, regardless of what side it is. You know, I've got friends that are definitely conservative. I'm like, man, I don't know. I never met Obama, but he seemed like a dude I could hang out with, like just a cool guy, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I just don't kind of go one way or the other, if you will, as far as like to where it's like, that's what's crazy about right now is like, everything is so polarizing. Never seen anything like it. And, but yeah, back to the authority thing. It's like, I guess it goes back to that once, whatever it is that has me believe that I can trust them, then it's not, you know, it's not as much of an issue, if that makes sense. You know, I guess I would compare it. Yeah. I mean, like my, and because that trust also goes both ways, like the president of my record label is an 8. I would consider him a healthy 8 who it's not, it's less about, you know, let's just, you know, let's, I know what's right. Let's just skip all the stuff and go straight here. but he becomes that healthy eight that is looking out for the other people, and you know, like being a leader is giving them a chance to shine and stuff. And so he hears everything that we say and we do, and I have no problem trusting him kind of running this thing, if you will.
Well, that's good. I some sixes I know, man, when they look back on their history and they have this sort of very ambivalent relationship with authority and authority figures, you know. And
oh, I do on certain levels. Don't get me wrong. Like, it's just, I guess in my thing, like, it's just, I'm trying to think of like, because, you know, our job is different. Like, I don't have a direct boss, if you will, but
right.
Even authorities like a promoter at a show who, you know, who want, like, if, and I'm not good with like change or don't, or when people step into what I'm been brought in to do. Great example. It's kind of petty, but like, we don't really do altar calls or whatever. I mean, we just kind of share what's on our heart and kind of stuff. And man, we did a show it's been a while now, but, and I remember getting there and last minute, like, hey, we're going to need you to do an altar call. And man, I blew my lid. Not because I'm anti that, it was because it was change and it was someone stepping in to what I think I do well and saying, I need you to do it differently. And that form of that, I mean, it derailed me so fast. And I was like, absolutely not. No way. Are you kidding me? No, how dare he? And then about 30 minutes later, I calmed down and probably ended up doing it. But it's just like that immediate thing was like this weird speaking into what I think I'm good at, you know, like, or speaking to my strengths like that, I struggle with big time. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, one of the things that's true about sixes is that they like predictability they like predictability. They like, typically they like institutions. They like, might be the church. It may be a particular theology. It may be a particular political thing, or they, they become very loyal to things.
Yeah.
In part because they're good people, in part because those things represent those institutions or that way of thinking represents security and safety. Mm-hmm. And so maybe someone's stepping in, you know, number one, you're screwing with my predictability here.
Right.
Number two, I really don't like this, the authority game that's happening right now. You know, you're blindsiding me. This should have been in the writer. I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
What? This thing, I don't adjust well, you know. And but what's so funny is, talking about authority issues, is if you, like, I've had things happen in publishing deals and in speaking things. And I've been in a 12-step group for a lot of years. And my sponsor, you know, for drug and alcohol, people with drug and alcohol problems. And my sponsor will say, you know, you're the talent. You know, you don't have to let yourself get pushed around here. You're the talent. I mean, like they rely on you for the money, right?
Right.
And it's like, I go, I forgot. I thought I was supposed to kind of give in and, you know, what if they don't like me? And, you know, it's like, no, actually, you don't actually have that to do that. You actually have a lot more power in this conversation than you realize. And I have to be reminded of it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it sounds like you have the same issue.
Yeah. And you know, with the people I trust, like whether it's on the road or whatever, I'll throw that fit and say that I'm the talent and then not react or respond in the way when push comes to shove, like this passiveness to where it's like, I usually end up doing it, but I have to in private throw my fit and remind someone in the room who probably doesn't care that I'm the talent, not in a diva way, but just like, you know, I got to tell myself that and then I'll step out and not say another word about it. But it is something that I wrestle with. But then there's this passiveness, and maybe that is the, you know, most of the time being a phobic to where it's like, you would never know. If I was meeting you, I'd be like, oh, of course we can do that. That'd be great. And I'll go to the dressing room. What is he doing? I'm coming unraveled inside. Why is, you know, but, oh, absolutely. We can do that. Yeah, sure. Yeah. It's, as long as you're happy.
And that's, okay. So this is the ingratiating side of the six. So the six is confronted with who they perceive as the authority figure, the person in charge, right? Whether it's the promoter or the record label guy or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And then maybe there's a sort of temporary resistance or immediate resistance, but it's kind of like this anxiety and this sort of self-questioning that sixes do a lot of. There's a lot of self-doubt in the six.
Yep.
And so then they start to vacillate. Was that too much? Was that too little? Like, you know, and then they ingratiate the authority figure because they perceive the authority figure as sort of being the one who's got their safety. You know what I mean? And it's like, I just got to kind of please the authority figure here just to get through this, you know, whatever. So let me ask you a question. Here's a question I ask everybody when they come on the show. Are you in therapy right now?
I am. Not right now. I'm not. No.
Okay.
Well, which, yes and no. We were in a, we were in therapy for about eight years, my wife and I. And we actually moved to Nashville, I think 7 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago. And we kind of, we did it kind of by video for a while, but it's probably about, I talked to her about once every 2 or 3 months, nothing like super consistent.
So
other than, than right now.
Right. All right. No. Point taken. So, what if you were in therapy now, or and if you're willing to share this, like, what's the big presenting issue that you need to work on right now as a six? Like, if you, you know, go as deep as you want, but like, what would the presenting problem be that you're like, man, I got to work on this right now?
I would say, the thing I struggle with the most is letting fear consume me. You know, to where it's like, it's always kind of been there, but almost to like a paralyzing extent sometimes, to where it's like, you know, that would be, you know, it's, I know it sounds, it maybe sounds cliche, but just, you know, for someone who for a living tells people to trust in God and stuff, like I struggle. The fears I have of like, you know, this is not going to work. I'm not in control or whatever. It's been an ongoing struggle, and I have great moments and tough ones, but I would say that's been an ongoing, you know, that, and, you know, I think it's kind of like the thing that I wrestled with the most, and it was most transforming for me in the last few years, was kind of getting a better grasp on my identity. And as far as just understanding that what I do is not who I am. And to the point to where, you know, I literally got to point through counseling to where it's like, if the band broke up right now, I would not lose sleep tonight. Like, you know, and so that area of my life is like, it's healthier than I've been, but there are other places where fear is like, you know, just, you know, my oldest son's a type 1 diabetic, and the hardest part of the pandemic is whenever someone originally said, whatever you do, don't let a diabetic get this. We, you know, we lived in a different kind of fear. You know, we had friends that are like, ah, it's kind of a joke. I don't wear my mask. I was like, man, I sure hope you're right. I'd love to be that person, but I can't afford it, you know, and to the point where he finally did get COVID over Christmas. You know, it was like, okay, here we go. And just expecting the worst. He had a fever for about 2 hours and that was it, literally. It was fine. But, and then this bitterness of, could we not have gotten this in March? Cause I changed almost like, and I'm so glad he's better. But then there's also this weird disappointment of, I was ready for the worst. Are you kidding me? Which is an awful thing to think when it's your son. Right. But it's like, we changed everything thinking, yeah, I don't know. That's a weird. So yeah, that's, it, but the sure. just being consumed and, by fear is an ongoing, you know, ongoing struggle.
You know, I back when I was in treatment, I had a therapist say something to me that blew my mind, and I've never forgotten it. I shared my story with her, you know, in all of its rawness. And she looked at me with the most compassionate voice. It was just in eyes. You know, when someone kind of locks you into that soft gaze and it's so caring, it's just so understanding and it's mesmerizing. Right. Mm-hmm. And she said, I think you've endured enough already. Don't you?
Wow.
I just started to weep, you know. It was like, I think you've endured enough already, don't you? And it was this I think, aren't you tired now?
Isn't
it time for something to change here? Because, you know, I had a terrible childhood. I came up with my own treatment plan, if you will. It was a pharmaceutical treatment plan, was not a particularly good one. Everybody's got one. So I'm not feeling like I'm like particularly screwed up. It's like everybody comes up with their own treatment plan.
Right.
It could be, you know, it doesn't have to be even an addiction, you know, although very often it is, whether it's, you know, who knows? Anyway, I don't want to go too far into it, but it sounds to me, or I guess let me ask you, what is it that you have endured enough of already that needs to change?
That's a great question. I was waiting for like, what's my favorite color, but let me,
you don't get this on that show, man.
Yeah. I would say, and that it's, I'm hesitant because I still do this for a living, but, I don't know. It's probably the celebrity part of it. That's something that I'm not a fan of. You know, doing shows like that's just the pandemic. I love doing shows is work. Like, and I just mean like the whole touring thing. Like I said, like, and maybe that is because there is since we're capable of any number, the four in me could just stay in the studio. And if people just listen to the music, I can just make it and never tour again. I think I would be, I'd be content. And it's just all the stuff that goes around it. Like, I just want to sing and make music and does this make sense? And I have an intimate relationship with that four part of me, but I just come to visit it once in a while when I write. Like, I'm not one that's looking to watch The Notebook, but
I am. How about Manchester by the Sea? I watched it twice.
Oh man. But that's the thing is like, I'll even to a point, part of me will make fun of it, but then if it's on when I walk in the room, I'm done. I'm going to watch it. It's like, I'd never sign up for it, but it's to me to get to what a four is for me is like burning calories. But when I'm there, it's just a painful yet revealing, intimate, uncomfortably revealing part of me. And that's why I have this love affair with making music, man. You talk about like, I have one song that I haven't talking about fear and this stuff. I have one song that I haven't been able to finish for years, literally have written two half of a verse and that's it. And I remember the first time I wrote it, I just wrote, this fear is very real. It's something I can taste and feel. And I kind of stopped and then just wrote, but so are you. And it wiped me out. Like I fell apart just trying to even say that to where I just pushed it aside. And for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, I'll stare at those lyrics and like, I'll finish it one day. And I don't know if there's a part of me that's like, I want to make sure that I truly believe that, or I don't know what it is that stops me. But every time I go there, it is an incredibly emotional, possibly healing. And I don't know, but there's something about it that's, that kind of has held me hostage. There's a truth that almost like that I want to believe in, but not sure if I have those days when I don't know if I do, you know,
say those lines again for me.
This fear is very real. It's something I can taste and feel, but so are you. And then the next line was the lies I try to leave relentlessly chase after me, but so do you. I love them. I love them, but it's like, and it says so much. And I'm like, just going to a hooky chorus just feels weird. So I just, you know, it's like, you know, I don't know. It's really precious to me, that thing. And I just set it aside and the moment will come. And
you're talking about fear. And I think certainly thematically, that's a six thing, but you know, here's the thing, you know, people are always like, again, this is how, when people misuse the Enneagram, it's like, oh, he's a six. He couldn't possibly write about you. No, he must be a seven because he's running away from fear. He doesn't want to write that song because he's a seven, you know, or it's like, no, man, it's like people are far more complex than that. Stop thinking. That's just like this sort of childish rudiment. Like, I got to tell you the truth. I'm going to say something's going to piss some people off. But when I go on Instagram and I see these stupid posts about the Enneagram, it's like, here's the, you know, and what they're doing is stereotyping people. They're right. they're not typing, mm-hmm. they're stereotyping. And it'll drive me batty because it's like, you don't really know, you don't understand the Enneagram. I mean, right. I hate to be condescending. I hate to be rude. I hate to be like, act like I'm the master guru. I'm not. I know a lot of people who are smarter at this than I am. But the fact of the matter is when I see that kind of trivialization of human beings where it's like, oh, what are we going to do? Just bring them down to one goofy stereotype? No. Okay. So you are a dominant six. Well, you've got four dimensions. You've got seven dimensions. You have trauma, which affects things. Right. You have, all of us do. And so, you know, we have to, nobody is a pure type. Nobody, mm-hmm. right? If you have the image of God, if you're a bearer mm-hmm. of the image of God, then you have dimensions of all of these types. You are a peacemaker. You are a challenger who cares about justice and power. You are a seven who cares about joy. You are a do you see where I'm going? It's like, so I'm always like, people, be discerning. Be discerning. Stop, you know, just using this thing like a bit of a card trick, you know, that's not what it is, you know, and I hate it. Well, you got a new record coming out in April, you said.
I do. Yes. That's what they tell me. It's I think April 30th is the last I heard. So,
and they're booking dates in September.
Yeah. We're doing a couple of one-offs. We just can't tour till September because every state's different and you've got stuff in a truck and you can't. So, there'll be, hopefully a handful of shows between now and then, but not a full tour till the fall, you know, Lord willing.
Well, man, I have so enjoyed this. This has been really, really rich. And now I'm going to be really pissed if we don't become friends.
Man, me too. I was like, okay, on the podcast, I need to do dinner with you guys, Randy, Katie. I got more questions. So.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Let's do that. Yeah. Then you get to meet my nine wife, who's a rock star, wonderful, self-aware, growing wife.
Yeah, my nine. I don't know if it's true, but I don't know about nines and fours, but nines and sixes work really well together. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, nines and fours do real well. She's I'm the kite. She's the string. What I always say, you know.
That's awesome.
She keeps me emotionally tethered to the ground. Well, hey, man, I know that everybody knows how to find Mercy Me, and they know how to find you online. It doesn't take a lot to figure it out, and I'm excited about the new record. And I'm just been one of those conversations that has enlarged me, and so I kind of like put a nice little thing into my day. And so thank you for being a wonderful guest, and let's go to that new Italian restaurant in Franklin, and which
absolutely.
I have been to. Okay,
I'm all in.
All right, I'm gonna talk to Randy and Katie. We're gonna set it up.
Perfect. Okay, that'd be great. I got plenty of time in my hands.
Hey, Typology Tribe, we thank you as always. Let me just send you out with my new outro, if you will, my new sign off, which is this prayer that I pray for the world, which is, may you have peace, may you have joy, may you have love, may you have healing, and may you have rest. Until next time.